Berger could not bring herself to sit at Moranda's desk right away, or to move his belongings aside. She arranged for Magnusson to talk to Moranda's family so that the widow could come herself when it was convenient, or send someone to sort out his things. Instead, she had an area cleared off the central desk in the heart of the newsroom, and there she set up her laptop and took command. It was chaotic. But 3 hours after she had taken the helm of SMP in such appalling circumstances, the front page went to press. Magnusson had put together a four-column article about Moranda's life and career. The page was designed around a black bordered portrait, almost all of it above the fold, with his unfinished editorial to the left and a frieze of photographs along the bottom edge. The layout was not perfect, but it had a strong emotional impact. Just before six, as Berger was going through the headlines on page two and discussing the text with the head of copy editing, Borchio approached and touched her shoulder. She looked up. "Could I have a word?" They went together to the coffee machine in the cafeteria. "I just wanted to say that I'm really very pleased with the way you took control today. I think you surprised us all."
"I didn't have much choice, but I may stumble a bit before I really get going."
"We understand that."
"We?
I mean the staff and the board. The board especially. But after what happened today, I'm more than ever persuaded that you were the ideal choice. You came here in the nick of time and you took charge in a very difficult situation." Berger almost blushed, but she had not done that since she was 14. "Could I give you a piece of advice?"
"Of course."
"I heard that you had a disagreement about a headline with Anders Holm."
"We didn't agree on the angle in the article about the government's tax proposal. He inserted an opinion into the headline in the news section, which is supposed to be neutral. Opinions should be reserved for the editorial page. And while I'm on this topic, I'll be writing editorials from time to time, but as I told you, I'm not active in any political party, so we have to solve the problem of who's going to be in charge of the editorial section."
"Magnusson can take over for the time being," said Borchio.
Erika shrugged. "It makes no difference to me whom you appoint, but it should be somebody who clearly stands for the newspaper's views. That's where they should be aired, not in the news section."
"Quite right. What I wanted to say was that you'll probably have to give Holm some concessions. He's worked at SMP a long time, and he's been news chief for 15 years. He knows what he's doing. He can be surly sometimes, but he's irreplaceable."
"I know. Moranda told me. But when it comes to policy, he's going to have to toe the line. I'm the one you hired to run the paper."
Borgshaw thought for a moment and said, "We're going to have to solve these problems as they come up." Giannini was both tired and irritated on Wednesday evening as she boarded the X-2000 at Göteborg Central Station. She felt as if she had been living on the X-2000 for a month. She bought a coffee in the restaurant car, went to her seat and opened the folder of notes from her last conversation with Salander, who was also the reason why she was feeling tired and irritated.
"She's hiding something. That little fool is not telling me the truth. And Mika is hiding something, too. God knows what they're playing at."
She also decided that since her brother and her client had not so far communicated with each other, the conspiracy, if it was one, had to be a tacit agreement that had developed naturally. She did not understand what it was about, but it had to be something that her brother considered important enough to conceal. She was afraid that it was a moral issue, because that was one of his weaknesses. He was Salander's friend. She knew her brother. She knew that he was loyal to the point of foolhardiness once he had made someone a friend, even if the friend was impossible and obviously flawed. She also knew that he could accept any number of idiocies from his friends, but that there was a boundary and it could not be overstepped. Where exactly this boundary was seemed to vary from one person to another, but she knew he had broken completely with people who had previously been close friends because they had done something that he regarded as beyond the pale. And he was inflexible. The break was forever. Giannini understood what went on in her brother's head, but she had no idea what Salander was up to. Sometimes she thought that there was nothing going on in there at all. She had gathered that Salander could be moody and withdrawn. Until she met her in person, Giannini had supposed it must be some phase, and that it was a question of gaining her trust. But after a month of conversations, ignoring the fact that the first 2 weeks had been wasted time because Salander was hardly able to speak, their communication was distinctly one-sided. Salander seemed at times to be in a deep depression, not the slightest interest in dealing with her situation or her future.
She simply did not grasp, or did not care, that the only way Giannini could provide her with an effective defence would be if she had access to all the facts. There was no way she was going to be able to work in the dark. Salander was sulky, and often just silent. When she did say something, she took a long time to think, and she chose her words carefully. Often she did not reply at all, and sometimes she would answer a question that Giannini had asked several days earlier. During the police interviews, Salander had sat in utter silence, staring straight ahead. With rare exceptions, she had refused to say a single word to the police. The exceptions were on those occasions when Inspector Erlander had asked her what she knew about Niedermann. Then she looked up at him and answered every question in a perfectly matter-of-fact way. As soon as he changed the subject, she lost interest. On principle, she knew, Salander never talked to the authorities. In this case, that was an advantage, despite the fact that she kept urging her client to answer questions from the police. Deep inside, she was pleased with Salander's silence. The reason was simple. It was a consistent silence. It contained no lies that could entangle her, no contradictory reasoning that would look bad in court. But she was astonished at how imperturbable Salander was. When they were alone, she had asked her why she so provocatively refused to talk to the police.
"They'll twist what I say and use it against me."
"But if you don't explain yourself, you risk being convicted anyway."
"Then that's how it'll have to be. I didn't make all this mess. And if they want to convict me, it's not my problem."
Salander had in the end described to her lawyer almost everything that had happened at Stallarholmen. All except one thing. She would not explain how Magga Lundin had ended up with a bullet in his foot. No matter how much she asked and nagged, Salander would just stare at her and smile her crooked smile. She had also told Giannini what had happened in Gossenberger, but she had not said anything about why she had confronted her father. Had she gone there expressly to murder him, as the prosecutor claimed, or was it to make him listen to reason? When Giannini raised the subject of her former guardian, Niels Bjurman, Salander said only that she was not the one who shot him. That particular murder was no longer one of the charges against her, and when Giannini reached the very crux of the whole chain of events, the role of Dr. Teleborian in the psychiatric clinic in 1991, Salander lapsed into such inexhaustible silence that it seemed she might never utter a word again.
"This is getting us nowhere," Giannini decided. "If she won't trust me, we're going to lose the case."